If you were alive in the time period and place of your book, late 1800s, Deadwood, South Dakota, who would you be? A cowpuncher, a vigilante, a sheriff, a preacher, a prostitute, or something else, and why?
Probably a prostitute. No. I can probably see myself being one of the, like the guy that plays the piano at the bar.
At the saloon?
At the saloon / bordello. That would probably be me, yeah.
That's right. I read somewhere that you initially thought you wanted to become the next Elton John.
Yes, that's right. I was a music major in college, and I played in clubs for quite a while, actually. But
what's your favorite club track to play?
Oh, probably, I liked Elton John songs, so I did quite a few of those. And I think Leave On was my favorite one to sing. It was, yeah. It was a good song.
That's a great one. Mm-hmm. Where's your music career these days?
I actually played at my book release party last month for the first time. It was the first time I had played in public in 30 years. So I was kind of a wreck, but I had fun.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Russell Rowland about his novel Arbuckle, the prequel to his 2002 debut In Open Spaces. This program contains adult themes and material. Listener discretion is advised. This book, Arbuckle, is the prequel to your 2002 debut In Open Spaces, and your 2007 book, The Watershed Years, is the sequel.
Right.
Why couldn't you shake these characters?
Well, I think the main reason is because it's based on my family, and that's probably one of the main things that I'm sort of obsessed with, is how growing up in this place shaped the people that I come from. I write about that a lot, not just with these three novels, but it comes up a lot in my other work too. So yeah, I wrote the first book, and I actually, my first instinct was to not follow up with something in the same vein. I wanted to not get stuck in, you know, pigeonholed. So I wrote a book that would eventually become High and Inside, but HarperCollins, who published the first book, didn't want that one. So he asked if I would be willing to try doing a sequel, and I started it, and he liked it. So I just made a big mistake and turned down an offer from them.
You wrote about that on your blog and your website. Can you speak to that more?
Yeah. So when I got my first book published, and I see this happen a lot, I went into what I call my everything I say is fascinating phase. Uh-huh. I became very full of myself. And I decided that the offer they gave me for that book was good, but I wanted it to be a little better. And I also wanted it to be, I wanted the second book to be a hardcover because I hadn't had that. So I told my editor that, and he said, well, if you submit the book again when it's done, I think I can do that for you. So I turned down their offer. And of course, he left the company, which I should have known would happen because I went through six editors with the first book, so I knew that was a danger. So anyway, yeah, that was a big regret.
When you switched from doing music to doing writing, you gave yourself a year to get published, and your first book took 15 years.
Yeah.
What's your other pieces of advice for, you know, young or beginning writers?
Well, you know, you're a writer. The hardest part is just keeping after it and trying to keep your faith alive that maybe someday someone will be interested, you know. And I was fortunate enough to get, when I finished my first novel, I was doing an internship at the Atlantic Monthly. And the editor there, the fiction editor, offered to help me get it published. And that was a huge boost of my confidence. So even though it took another 11 years, I mean, he wasn't able to do it. I had this knowledge that, you know, somebody of that stature believed in me. So I kind of, I just tapped into that when I needed to, you know, convince myself that it was worth continuing, you know?
Right. And I think about you being a third generation Montanan. And was there some sort of lure of the East Coast? And, you know, the Atlantic is pretty fancy. And
yeah. Yeah, for some reason, I always wanted to live in Boston. So when I applied for grad schools, I applied to two grad schools, Missoula and Boston. Mm-hmm. And I got into both. And I just thought, you know, I want to check out Boston. So, yeah, I was there for 2 years and I really liked it. But I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday about this. I never felt at home there. I mean, I liked it, but I'm a Montanan, mm-hmm. you know.
You talk about Raymond Carver's work as maybe inspirational. What was the infection you got from his work?
I think it was the fact that he wrote about blue collar people struggling and people with drinking problems. I mean, those were my people. So I think a lot of it was, a lot of the appeal of his writing was that. But I also loved his spare style. And then, you know, probably like a lot of people that were in grad school at the time, I tried to write like him for a long time. And I'm sure he impacted my style quite a bit. But when I started writing about Montana in earnest, it was a pretty dramatic shift in style.
When did you know that you were writing a trilogy?
Well, when the sequel came out, I kind of thought I was done with it. In fact, I think I told anyone who was interested that I wasn't going to write anymore after that. But I became pretty fascinated with the whole vigilante period in our state history. And because it was near where they met, you know, my great-grandfather was not involved in that at all. So the part in the book where he gets wrapped up in that is totally fictional. But I wanted to try to explore how that impacted the people that lived around that part of the country. And I also wanted to try to explore what it was like for people in that time and place to deal with rape and other violent acts. I mean, because there was so much of it. And, you know, obviously it was a time when people didn't really talk about it. So that was another thing that I was really interested in trying to explore with this book. Because, like, you know, how did that affect marriages, friendships, and all that?
Those are big themes. I want to clarify, when you say he got wrapped up with vigilantes, you mean George Arbuckle.
Yeah.
Okay, and the region specifically you're talking about in the United States is?
The Black Hills, basically.
One of the things that struck me is that there seem to be some eerie parallels between your book and modern times, mm-hmm. including this notion of fake news, right, or mm-hmm. news that isn't well reported, mm-hmm. the Me Too movement and this rape and abortion and sexual assault and women's voices rising up. How conscious of those parallels were you as you were writing this?
Very. Yeah, I wanted to sort of convey how little has changed, especially when Catherine goes public with her rape. I wanted to show how I know enough about that region and the way people deal with that kind of stuff to know that if anyone did that, it would be very much frowned upon. So I wanted to explore how that would play out. And the abortion thing, too. I wanted to delve into how difficult it must have been for someone to make that decision back in that time period.
And the risks associated.
Exactly, yeah.
So you've mentioned Catherine.
Yeah.
Catherine Boland is a character. Can you give us just a character sketch of her?
Well, she's a Spitfire, and apparently my great-grandmother, that is her name, and that was her personality, too. One of my favorite stories about her was that how she rode in a blizzard to Alzada to work at the polls, you know, way before she was allowed to vote. But she felt that strongly about being part of the process. She was very involved in starting the women's club in Albion, Alzada area, and just someone who was very socially conscious and outspoken. I had a lot of fun with that character.
I was wondering, it seemed like it. And you vacillate points of view between first person, Catherine's perspective, yeah. and then this third person sort of omniscient.
Right.
What was it like to inhabit Catherine's voice?
Yeah, that was a challenge. It's the first time I've written from a woman's point of view. It was hard. It was harder than I thought it would be. But I just tried to get in touch with her humanness, I guess, basically. And especially with the marriage, I think that was probably the most challenging part, was trying to imagine what it must have been like to be with somebody who's so incommunicative and so shut down.
Can you describe maybe Catherine's sense of identity in the marriage and George's?
It's a typical marriage in some ways in that they really do love each other and they fall for each other in a pretty dramatic way. But from that point forward, I think for George, the marriage is very much an inconvenience and something that he has absolutely no coping ability with, which I've seen play out with a lot of the men in my family. So it was pretty easy to get that character's perspective. But with Catherine, I think from the time that especially after the rape, it becomes very clear to her that there are limitations to her husband, that she's either going to have to just settle for that or leave. And I don't think she's comes from the kind of stock that leaves. So she learns how to contend with just being with somebody that's probably not going to change.
I'm thinking about, there's this tipping point in the book where we start and Catherine is this spitfire woman on her own who's even being judged for being unmarried, mm-hmm. and holding down a job, you know, in the sort of big city, you know, Deadwood. Yeah, right. She was a business owner even. And then the second half of the book is a domestic life. I want to talk about that turn, but first I want to have you read a scene of Catherine in the city.
I sat on a rough wooden bench on Main Street in Deadwood, my purse resting like a poodle on my lap. For my first day at the new job, I had worn my favorite dress, made from forest green satin. I made this dress for last year's Christmas pageant, and people complimented me all night long about how good it looked with my red hair. The dress made me happy. I could actually feel a difference in the way I moved in this dress, as if I could somehow internalize its beauty. I'd worn it to every important occasion since. I studied my new town. Deadwood was squeezed into a narrow wedge between two mountains, as if a mythical axe had been pounded into the mountain range and left its impression. The houses that were not on the main streets teetered precariously on these steep inclines, many of them propped up with lodge poles formed from the surrounding forest. Along the main street were more saloons than I'd ever seen in one town. 100 yards away, I could make out the balcony of the Gem Theater, known as the most notorious of Deadwood's many brothels. I would have never considered moving to Deadwood a few years before, when the town was a musty swamp of murder and rampant lawlessness. According to rumor, every outlaw in the Black Hills trickled into Deadwood, like pebbles rolling down those steep mountainsides. Just days after the most recent sheriff arrived in Deadwood, Wild Bill Hickok had been shot in the back and killed. That was big news, and it was also the final straw. Sheriff Pierre Lafont informed everyone that he wasn't going to tolerate having the locals living in constant fear for their lives. Lafont recruited good deputies, and the turnaround had been dramatic, but I worried about my decision. Despite the stories that the town had been transformed, I knew it was still a lot more dangerous than most towns in the area. And now that I was here, I could feel it. It was the way people avoided looking at each other, the way they walked, with their bodies slightly turned away.
If you're just joining us, that's Russell Rowland reading from his novel Arbuckle. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What was curious to me, Russell, is you start Catherine out as this independent woman. And she slides into this domestic life, mother cooking for the men. And I was wondering, I think I felt some grief. Like, I missed the sassy woman who worked at the bank. Mm-hmm. And I also felt instinctually like you did that because that was how it was. What was your process like of writing these two versions of Catherine?
Well, that was exactly what was going through my mind, was that it was a time when even the most spirited women usually ended up being wives. Catherine Boland actually did own a hat shop in Belfouche, South Dakota. She was the first woman to have her own business there. So she was a trailblazer. But when you look at pictures of her later in life, she is weighed down with the weight of it. Her shoulders sag. She became heavy. And you can just tell that the burden of living out in that place. They didn't have phones. They didn't have water. They didn't have electricity. So it was a lot of work. Let's see. They had, I think, 6 kids. So it was a drudgery. Despite her efforts to be such a vital part of the community, I think it really did weigh her down. And you know, that happened a lot.
In what ways are you like Catherine?
Oh, probably I get overwhelmed with emotions sometimes.
Have you ever stopped a crime from happening?
Yeah. I was in a bar one time. Well, I was actually in a club in Boston. I was watching a band play, and these two guys got into a scuffle right next to me, and it was the weirdest. It was one of those kind of like extra strength kind of deals. I reached out and grabbed each of them by the shoulder and just pulled them apart.
Wow.
It was weird. And they both looked at me like, whoa, what was that? That was kind of fun.
In what ways are you like George Arbuckle?
Well, George is a very good example of most of the men that I grew up with and that I became very out of touch with how to just cope with the interactions with other people, especially family members. I struggled with that a lot especially when I was a younger man.
What can you say about your fascination with vigilantes?
I think it's really fascinating that Montana has become enamored with these guys because they were pretty out of control for most of the time that they were active. They started out with good intentions, which I think is probably often the case in those kind of situations. But if you read there's an amazing book called A Decent Orderly Lynching that's about the vigilantes, and they quickly lost control and became completely obsessed with killing anybody that disagreed with them. There was 2 lawyers that were banished from Bannock in the early days because they were outspoken about these guys, and they just got rid of them. They ran off to Salt Lake City, and one of them actually filed a lawsuit later and won. It's a fascinating history because I think it's a pretty strong statement about how Montana views this kind of, you know, the libertarian mentality. It's always been romanticized more than it should have been, I think.
You write a lot about Montana. What do you love about Montana?
That's hard to sum up, but it's obviously beautiful. There is something about the people here that is completely unique. And I've lived in 12 different states since I graduated from high school. So I know this to be true because everywhere I've lived, there's this phenomena where you meet people and you say, there's something about that person. And it turns out they're from Montana. It's happened to me so many times.
Yeah.
And there's a pride in this place that is also very unique. When I lived on the East Coast and you asked people where they were from, they didn't say their state. They always named their town. Montana there's a unique connection here between the people and this place for sure. So I've always been very intrigued about what it is. And I think it's more than just the beauty. I mean, I think there's something about the spirit here that's really unique and special.
You recently wrote a book where you went to all 56 counties and talked with people.
Yeah.
What was the most surprising thing that happened on that adventure?
Well, that whole book was a surprise. It was so much fun. I was expecting to run into a lot more resistance from people on that trip, but it was absolutely amazing how every town I went to and told people what I was doing, they just couldn't wait to tell their stories. You know, people love to tell their stories. And I was really amazed by the optimism of people in Montana, despite some of these towns were, you know, some of the county seats, especially in eastern Montana, are in really bad shape. It just blew my mind how people were still sort of clinging to the idea that things will eventually turn around, you know. Yeah, I guess mostly the biggest surprise was how it takes a lot to kill the spirit of this place. And then on the other hand, you've got this incredibly high suicide rate. So there's a sort of duality to this place that's fascinating to me also, you know. The fact that people won't talk about what's bothering them is also a big, it's like the other side of the coin, basically, the denial.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to imagine your approach. How did you get people into conversation, and how did you build a sense of relationship or trust?
Mostly I started with the museums. You know, the volunteers in the museums are always interesting people, people that are interested, and so they provided a great conduit for any kind of, you know, they were always willing to tell me who I should talk to in town. But I approached a lot of people cold because I didn't want to have people prepared with answers for what I was going to ask. I wanted to get a fairly spontaneous reaction from people about how they feel about this place. So I approached a lot of people in coffee shops and restaurants and just told them what I was doing. And there was only a couple of situations where people were sort of like wary, but it didn't happen often.
What kinds of things did you ask?
I asked a lot of questions about the history, but I also asked questions about what they're struggling with now, what their main concerns are as far as the region they live in and, you know, how they see their future playing out, that kind of stuff.
What's your main concern for Billings?
Oh, Billings. Billings has a growing artistic community, which has been really fun to watch. I've lived there 11 years now since I came back. But it's still really hard to get the community at large interested in anything that's creative. And I'm not sure why that is, because there's a lot of smart people there with means. There's a lot of money there. I'm not sure what gets in the way of that kind of activities in Billings. I haven't quite figured that out. I think a lot of it has to do with just sort of presenting a sort of an image. So even when people seem to be interested, it's just because they want to appear like they are. I don't know. I worry about Billings becoming too overwhelmed with money so that it loses its Montana-ness. You know, it doesn't really feel as much like a Montana town as it used to.
What's missing?
Mainly that, I think. The interest in creative, the arts, the culture of Montana. It feels like that's sort of dying there.
What's your next book?
My next book is actually another novel. This one was fun. When I was 10, I lived on a ranch between Billings and Sheridan. It was right just across the border. So we went to a one-room school for 2 years, and I got a real taste of what it's like to be an outsider, because we were not accepted in this community. My dad was hired to manage this ranch that was run by guys that had been there forever. And they resented him being given the job as manager of the ranch. So So I used that setting and threw in a murder. So the book starts with a fight between the son of this new family and one of the other kids at school. The kid hits the other kid with a bat. This local rancher goes to the father and gives him a sort of a gentle warning about making a bad first impression. And that rancher ends up getting beaten to death with a bat just a couple days later. So, of course, everyone's suspicion is immediately on the new guy. It's a community study, basically. Mm-hmm. I was really pleased to sell that novel to a publisher, so I don't have to publish it myself. I'm excited about that.
That's right. Are you 56 Counties Press?
Yes, that's me. Yeah.
I realize I'm sitting in the presence of someone I never thought I would get a chance to sit with. One of your former jobs was writing fortunes for cookies. I want to know, what does it entail to write for fortune cookies?
That is an excellent question. That was such a weird fluke. When I lived in San Francisco, I worked for a guy who had a typing service. That was what we did. We typed documents. And so it was right about the time when they were making the transition from typewriters to computers. Anyway, after I left that job, he got a visit from a guy who was looking for someone to write fortune cookies. And he was not a writer. So he got in touch with me and asked me if I was interested. So I went to visit this guy. He was Chinese. He didn't speak very good English. And he said, I need someone to write fortunes. Do you want to do it? And that was the entire interview. Mm-hmm. So I agreed to do it. He said, well, what do you charge? Which was funny because it made it sound like this is something I do all the time. You know, I said, well, what did you pay the last person? So he said, 10 cents a fortune. So he seemed desperate. So I asked him, I asked for 25 cents and he said, I'll pay you 35.
Wow. How many fortunes did you write in the course?
700. And actually after the first couple of hundred, I figured out how much I was going to get and it was ridiculous. So I asked for a raise and he ended up paying me 75 cents for the rest of them. Yeah, it led to two game shows. That was the funniest part. I was on To Tell the Truth and I've Got a Secret.
Wow.
Yeah. I earned way more money from those than I did from the fortune cookie writing.
When he's not touring Montana's 56 counties, Russell Rowland lives in Billings, Montana. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.